I'm Carl Quintanilla. You're listening to CNBC's Tech Check. Our show is live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Listen in.
Happy Thursday morning. We are checking your tech. Welcome to Tech Check. I'm John Fort with Julia Boorstin. Deirdre and Carl have the morning off. Coming up on the show today, Apple's App Store concession, how pressure coming from overseas is changing the rules for all developers. Plus, Alphabet stock at another all-time high. But listen up, new numbers out of YouTube Music could be the sound of the next growth driver. And then tips for tweets. Will users pay for access to their favorite follows? And we will start with Apple, a series of lawsuits and regulatory challenges around the world, changing the way Apple runs its app store. New last night as part of a settlement with a Japanese regulatory probe that's been going on for 5 years. Apple says developers of readers apps, that includes newspapers, books, audio, music, and video, are not going to be able to include links within their apps for customers to sign up for paid accounts. A big caveat here, Netflix and Spotify do seem to fall into that category, but gaming and in-app purchases, which account for about 90% of App Store revenue, do not. This, of course, follows South Korean legislation that ensures Google and Apple are going to have to let app developers use alternate payment systems there. And if that's not enough, India trying to strike while the iron's hot this morning, filing their own antitrust suit against Apple, alleging the 30% commission fees stifle competition. The overall thrust of all these challenges and changes is that Apple's grip on that 30% fee that it charges some developers, not all, that's eroding the walled garden ecosystem of the App Store, perhaps under some threat. Julia, I think that this latest shift out of Japan, especially if it does, in fact, apply to the likes of Spotify, of Netflix, if you can actually buy Kindle books directly, which it's not clear that you'd be able to. But that would be a big deal, not only for consumers, but for the broader ecosystem.
Absolutely. Look, we have to note that we're not entirely sure how this is going to work yet. It seems, according to sources close to the situation, that companies such as Spotify are still trying to figure out whether and how this applies to them. But this is evidence of the wall around that garden starting to crumble. The days of the set 30% fee are over. And I agree with you, John, that this is going to be a really crucial moment to see how Apple handles those in-app purchases. Of course, that is at the heart of the Epic lawsuit against Apple. They want to make sure that they control their own payment ecosystem. And I think what we're seeing here is Apple making some concessions. The question is, how many more concessions are yet to come? Is this the first, is what we've been talking about for the past week, sort of the first, you know, half dozen of another dozen more concessions? Yeah. Or is this really going to be it for a while?
But I don't think either way that this is some huge threat to Apple's business model, right? I mean, we've got to remember, mostly Apple sells devices and then it vertically integrates with, you know, the chips, the hardware, the software, the services, and that's nice. But the bulk of Apple's revenue and business comes from selling devices and experiences that people love. Now, if this particular services model has gotten long in the tooth, people, regulators, legislators around the world don't like it anymore, there are so many other ways that Apple can charge besides this, it seems to me.
Yes, they certainly have a diversified revenue stream, and this does remind us that there are all these other subscription revenues that they are trying to build, you know, things like paying for Apple TV Plus, Apple Music, all of these different services. They're offering different ways to lock people into the ecosystem, and I believe that health is going to increasingly be a big part of that with all the different options on the Apple Watch. Now, meanwhile, developers large and small reacting to this news this morning, some saying the new rules just serve to complicate things rather than fix the underlying issues. Epic's Tim Sweeney tweeting that Apple should open up iOS completely. Of course, the Fortnite maker is in its own battle with Tim Cook and the App Store. So the overall take so far seems to be that developers are not entirely satisfied with the changes they've seen. Another James Thompson writing, quote, again, with the let's add more complicated rules in an effort to stave off antitrust approach rather than just ripping up the payment system Band-Aid. So, John, I think it's going to be really interesting to see not just how these developers react as they sort out what it means on a practical basis, but also sort of what the next step is from Apple. And is this really just about getting ahead of the regulatory crackdown? And what will the Epic ruling be? Because that is really the next shoe to drop.
Yeah, let's talk about it. With us now to weigh in, CNBC contributor Casey Newton, editor of Platformer. Casey, you cover all of these platforms, and here's one from Apple, the App Store, where consumers seem to like it, right? Apple has shown in the market that they're able to make more money through the App Store, despite the fact that Google Play, the Android ecosystem, is bigger. But some changes they're having to make, more and more significant, seems like.
That's right. And keep in mind that, you know, as far as this ruling, this is in an area where Apple was competing directly against other companies on a totally unfair playing field, right? Apple gets to advertise Apple Music to you. It doesn't have to pay a 30% fee to itself, whereas Spotify has to give up that huge portion of its margin every single month to Apple. So this is a really narrow case, but I think it was really necessary to begin to push back on some of these distortions in the market that were created by this iOS and Android duopoly.
I mean, I keep thinking about Walmart and Albertsons and all kinds of stores where you can go and there are store brands, right, that compete on the shelf with the name brands and you can buy them for less. And it's kind of a similar thing. You could argue that, you know, if you've only got that grocery store in your neighborhood, it kind of has a local equivalent of a monopoly. But the digital world is different, perhaps because it's so pervasive, perhaps because of the sorts of tie-ins that they can engineer to so many different products.
That's right. I mean, our entire lives are mediated through this phones. It controls, you know, what TV do you watch? What music do you listen to? What books do you read? What games do you play? Where do you shop? Right. The list goes on and on. And, you know, to your point, you know, what if we lived in a world with only two stores? We would probably want to have some pretty strict antitrust rules, making sure that everybody got a fair shot to sell their wares.
Casey, I'm curious what your thoughts are about this game ecosystem, because, of course, payments from games are the most important piece of the App Store revenue, the biggest piece of App Store revenue. What do you think Apple's going to do there? Do you think they will take preemptive steps, or do you think it's going to all hinge on the Epic ruling?
You know, if I had to guess, I would say they're going to wait for the outcome of that trial. You know, I suppose that a settlement could be reached in the meantime. But, you know, as you noted earlier, Julia, this is the bulk of the App Store revenue. It is the gaming revenue. So these changes that we've seen Apple make in recent days are sort of around the edges. But I think you can expect to see Apple still do everything it can to protect the lion's share of the revenue that's coming from the App Store. And that's going to mean waiting to see how these Epic cases around the world play out.
Yes, Casey, as I work to protect that that bulk of the revenue, that is games, I wonder what you see Apple doing more broadly. You know, earlier John was talking about all these different businesses that Apple is in, and I'm very interested in the services business, the subscription business. Where do you see Apple having the most opportunity to grow? Because maybe it's not going to be the App Store anymore.
That's right. I mean, they have huge opportunities to grow if they can invent, right? Like in the near term, they're absolutely going to be investing more in the Apple Watch. I think they've discovered that health is the killer app for them. Also, let's keep in mind that the pandemic has led to a huge surge in sales for basic hardware like MacBooks, iMacs, tablets. iPhone obviously still have room to grow there as well. But the real next frontier is, can they build a headset that we're all going to want to wear around all day? Can they build augmented reality glasses? Can they finally ship a car out of Cupertino? They've been working on it for a decade. So there's still any number of things Apple could do. It's the richest company in the world, which is what makes some of its sort of protectionist stances on its App Store, I think, so unpalatable to regulators.
Yeah. Well, and Casey, they could also do software and tools to enable services across lots of different platforms, lots of different opportunities there. Casey, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Meantime, YouTube Music hitting a milestone. Google announcing it has signed up 50 million paid subscribers for YouTube Premium. Now, this number includes both those just paying for YouTube Music as well as YouTube Premium subscribers. They sign up for the service. They get music as part of the broader YouTube Premium service. That is ad-free access to YouTube as well as original content. And it also includes customers on the free trial. Now, because of the varied user base, it is tough to compare this 50 million number apples to apples. Spotify reported 165 million paid subscribers this past quarter, and Apple doesn't break out its music numbers on a quarterly basis, but it did boast about 700 million paid subscribers for all of its services. Tomorrow, we'll be talking to YouTube's chief business officer, Robert Kyncl, about all these numbers to break down YouTube's impact across the entertainment and music landscape. But John, I'm excited to talk to Kyncl tomorrow. But for now, I just want to point out that YouTube has really been building the subscription service while everyone's been talking about ad revenue. They've got this whole other game in the works.
Yeah, and that Apple subscriber number is really, I think, just everybody who's on like the App Store, every other company, if they are doing subscriptions, then Apple counts that as subscriptions that are running through them. But I think Apple Music in 2019 had something like 60 million paid subs, up from 50 million a few months earlier. There's some estimates that they're around, you know, maybe mid-70s right now. So this for YouTube, which is like master of the universe when it comes to advertising around video content and music content, is really impressive. And I think points to how these huge tech companies, Google, Apple, you know, two of the biggest, even if you mess with one little pot of money that they have over here and how they run the App Store, there are opportunities for them to reach into so many different places because of the loyalty that they have from consumers and just the raw number of touch points that consumers have with them. They've got so many different upsell opportunities. I've stunned you into
yeah,
silence.
Yeah, John, I just think... Yeah, no, just lost audio for a second there. But John, no, I think what's amazing is for so long we talked about how it's hard to convert people to paying for something that they're used to getting for free. Will YouTube ever get people to pay? How many people really want to access those music videos and YouTube clips without ads? And it turns out quite a lot of them, 50 million. So kind of amazing that consumers are not as predictable as they might seem. Now, finally, super followers are here on Twitter. Twitter launching its highly anticipated subscription service. Creators in the U.S. can charge $2.99, $4.99, or $9.99 per month for exclusive tweets. For creators to qualify, they need at least 10,000 followers to have tweeted at least 25 times in the past month. They need to be based in the U.S. and over 18 years of age. For now, only iOS users in the U.S. and Canada can super follow accounts in the test group. But the company plans to roll out the option on iOS in more countries in the coming weeks, as well as Android and web versions in the future. John, both you and I qualify. Are we going to start doing this? How many people do we think would actually pay to follow either us or people with many, many more followers?
I don't think I produce the type of content that is probably going to be most popular for super follows out there. And I'm just going to be vague about that in my question to you, Julia, because I'm kind of asking what sorts of creators, especially given what we just saw with OnlyFans, do you think are going to be the first out of the gate offering subscriber-only content?
Well, honestly, I think it's going to be comedians. I think people are going to want to be entertained. I think it's going to be comedians and sort of journalists. It's going to be a little bit of the Substack model because we know that journalists love Twitter. And then it's going to be people like comedians and actors who are going to be trying to monetize their fan base. So, you know, Twitter says this is going to be open for all sorts of different people. But I think that we're going to really see the people with millions of followers and have really devoted fan base, John.
I think it's going to be the Kardashians, right, of the world, and models. I don't know, but I hope you're right. I hope, you know, comedians, we could all use a laugh right now. All right, we're also going to continue to monitor the severe weather. It's been a serious situation here occurring in the northeastern United States. Historic flooding and reports of tornadoes. This video just came into the newsroom from Bridgewater, New Jersey, which is west of New York City. That's the home of the minor league Somerset Patriots baseball team. And that stadium covered in water. This shows the magnitude of this powerful storm that's run up the East Coast, causing floods and tornadoes. We will have updates throughout the day here on CNBC, including this hour at 11:30. Julia.
Just horrifying images there. And after the break, we talk with former PayPal COO David Sacks on the rise of fintech and his new investment in social audio. A big hour of Tech Tech is just getting started.
Let's get a gut check on C3 AI. We just heard from CEO Tom Siebel yesterday with that Google Cloud deal. The stock tumbling after it reported a wider than expected loss for its most recent quarter and delivered weaker guidance for the current quarter than expected. Actually, it was just about in line. Shares this morning down more than 7%. Julia.
And the social audio space keeps getting more crowded, from new startups like Clubhouse to Facebook, Twitter, and now Amazon is reportedly working on live audio and podcasting tools. Today, a new app called Callin is launching, and it aims to be a tool for social podcasting. And while it does have live capabilities, what makes it different is that users can save the audio after and edit it within the app and turn it into a podcast. Joining us now is David Sacks. He's co-founder of Callin and a general partner at Kraft Ventures. He's also former COO of PayPal. David, thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me, Julia.
So, David, I know you're a podcaster yourself, but you've invested in so many different companies and industries. Why get into the social audio space when it's already so crowded?
Well, because I don't think the problem has really been solved of how you make podcasting really easy. So for about the last year and a half, I've been doing this pod with a few friends called the All-In Pod. We started doing it during COVID because it was the only way we could see each other, and it kind of kept us sane. And I learned a lot about podcasting from doing that. And what I discovered is just actually how difficult it is. About 6 hours of post-production goes into every episode of the pod that we do. And if it wasn't for my bestie, Jason, who you guys know well, I never would have figured it out. So what I set out to do with this team is make podcasting as simple as just pushing a button. It's like starting a room on a social audio site, but instead of the content being ephemeral, it gets recorded and saved. And then you can do post-production in the app. We automate all of that sort of sound engineering away, so you don't have to worry about it. And then you can publish it and share it on social media. So no one has really bridged or combined these concepts of social audio and podcasting before. And that's what we've done in this app. We call it social podcasting. It's really a new experience that hasn't existed before.
Interesting. Now, I want you to put this in context of your other investments. We've been talking so much on this show about fintech. You invested in a firm which earlier this week announced a big deal with Amazon. Do you see more opportunity in the fintech space now? And how transformative do you think these big deals, like the partnership between a firm and Amazon, will be for this buy now, pay later space?
Yeah, I think it's going to be huge because obviously Amazon is the biggest player in e-commerce, and this is going to expose a lot more transaction volume to these, to, like you said, the buy now, pay later space. I was a seed investor in Affirm, just full disclosure. I supported Max back when this was just a seed company, and it's been amazing to see what he's done with it. We also sold them a company last year called Returnly, which which advances credit against returns, which is kind of similar to the way that Affirm advances credit against purchases. So I think this whole idea of extending credit at the point of sale, which is what Max came up with, is a brilliant idea. A lot of people aren't ready to make pay the full purchase price at the time of sale, and they need help sort of spacing out the payments, but they don't want to pay credit card fees with all the surprise penalties. And so, what Max has done here at Affirm is create a new way for people to get credit at the point of sale. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, David, tell me how you think about the risk there to that model, because I understand the AI behind it. Max is super smart, of course. We'll work with you at PayPal before, but so much of this data is from a bull market where consumers have had some pretty low interest rates. What happens when the market turns down and there are more defaults on credit? What happens when access to capital is not so easy for buy now, pay later players?
Well, this is why I have a lot of confidence in Max, is because he's lived through those down cycles. You know, we went through the dot-com crash at PayPal. We saw actually how a lot of the credit underwriting decisions we made at PayPal turned out not to be so great. And Max is the guy at PayPal who solved the fraud problem. So you're right that I think the critical skill set in this space is the ability to underwrite a credit decision and being able to stress test those decisions against, you know, all future possibilities like a sudden down market. That is the key skill set here, and I'm confident in Max's ability to do that.
Are we seeing, I want to go back to, the app that you've created and social audio. Are we seeing the difference between a good social app and a good creator tool? Because disappearing content is great if you're a teenager, but not if you're a creator. You created it on purpose, right, and you want it to stick around. So is this a problem for companies, apps like Clubhouse that are still into ephemerality? Is it part of the reason why we see LinkedIn getting rid of stories? Because, hey, if you're on LinkedIn, you sort of want your stuff to stay there.
I think it's a real difference in founder visions here. I think that the social audio space, as it's been conceived by the founders in that space, has been very focused on, like you said, ephemeral experiences, live experiences. And I think that's great. I think there's definitely a place in this world for sort of the online cocktail party. That's not what we're trying to do with Call-In. What we're trying to do here is long-tail podcasting, is let anybody who wants to create an audio show very easily go online and do that. And you're right, it is way too hard. And I never would have figured it out if it wasn't for the help of my friends who really just, you know, made it turnkey for me to show up. But what we're trying to do with Call-In is let anybody who, you know, has something to say, turn their iPhone into a sound studio and just start recording their podcast. And they can now do it in front of a live studio audience. I do think that that live experience adds a lot of energy to a room, because you can call people up to ask their questions. So there's something powerful there in terms of social audio, but we're not using it for anything ephemeral. We're using it to create a new kind of podcasting experience.
Well, I wish we could talk to you for much longer. I hope you'll come back soon so we can ask you about everything else going on in this space. Thanks so much for joining us, David Sacks.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Call-In. Want to try that out. Now, Elizabeth Holmes back in court today as jury selection continues in that fraud trial. The reporter who first explained the scandal behind Theranos, author of Bad Blood, John Carreyrou, is with us next. Welcome back to Tech Check. Heading into the bottom of the hour here, I'm John Fort with Julia Boorstin. Just a minute, we're live outside the courthouse as Elizabeth Holmes awaits trial. But first, let's get a news update with Tyler Matheson. Tyler.
All right, John, thank you very much. Here's what's happening at this hour. Massive flooding from Pennsylvania to Connecticut has killed at least 22 people. Three more people are missing, including two swept away by flood waters in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and another in Connecticut. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy says he is there to help everyone recover.
If you're a small business, you're barely getting back on your feet from a pandemic and you get whacked by this, and you ask yourself rightfully, life's not so fair sometimes, but I promise that we will stay with everybody, and it won't be a short road, but we will stay with them on that road to recovery.
Never seen rain like it in my life. Transportation interruptions from the storms are broadening. United Airlines has suspended operations at Newark Airport. Hard hit there. One of the carrier's major hubs, of course. Trains, other mass transit reporting major outages. Half of New York City's subway lines are still suspended or disrupted. And stepping away from the storms, a U.S. trade deficit has pulled back from record levels set in June. The July trade gap fell 4% to $70 billion, thanks to a jump in exports. And it says right here, back to you. I don't know whether this is John, and I hope you got through the storms okay.
I did indeed. Lots of water, Tyler, indeed.
Crazy.
We want people to stay safe, of course. Meanwhile, the Elizabeth Holmes trial back in the limelight this week. The Theranos founder facing a dozen counts of wire fraud and conspiracy. Jury selection expected to wrap up today. Our next guest, known for exposing the Theranos scandal and author of Bad Blood, which chronicled the rise and fall of the company, joins us now outside the courthouse, John Carreyrou. John, the thing that has struck me most recently is the image shift of Elizabeth Holmes. In the past, she projected control. She projected being completely self-contained and decisive. Now, heading into this trial, we're getting a very different picture of her being controlled by others. Which is the accurate picture? Is it too soon to tell?
It's exactly right. I mean, when she was at the height of her fame in 2014-15, she was this incredibly self-possessed young woman who entranced audiences. She came off as incredibly smart, incredibly charming, incredibly charismatic. And now the defense would have us believe that, in fact, she was the victim of an abusive boyfriend who was the number two executive at Theranos, and that this person, Sonny Balwani, held her in his thrall and deprived her of her free will and her agency, and so that she couldn't make the decision to defraud anyone because she was his puppet and he was the puppeteer. I personally don't buy this theory, but it's not me who matters. It's the jurors who are going to get impaneled this morning. Will they go for this defense theory? And I think the trial, the outcome of the trial is going to hinge on this.
I'm curious what you think the jurors are going to be focused on. I was so struck by the note that she's been trying to make eye contact with everyone when they walk into the room. She's been such a public figure. Do you think the jury is going to buy this image, you know, remodel, and are they going to buy it? And this idea that she was being manipulated by someone who was not in the press for so many years.
Right. As I said in my podcast, there's a mountain of evidence against her, both documentary evidence, emails and so forth, and a ton of witnesses that the prosecution is going to call to the stand. So her best chance to get off, to get acquitted, is not to fight the facts, to fight this on the facts, but to try to get the jurors to sympathize with her. And that's what this defense, which in my podcast I call the Svengali defense, is all about. It's about making Sonny Balwani, her ex-boyfriend, her ex-number two at Theranos, the villain, and making it seem like she was not pulling the strings, like he was pulling the strings. I think it's very hard to tell whether the jury will go for this. I think time will tell. I think we'll start getting a feel for it in coming weeks when the trial starts.
Now, John, I read that you predicted that she was going to be convicted, Elizabeth Holmes was going to be convicted of wire fraud. Tell me what led you to make this prediction.
Well, wire fraud is the easiest statute, to build this case on. All the jurors need to understand is whether or not she lied and made misrepresentations to investors when she pitched them Theranos. And if it turns out that the prosecution can prove that she was telling lies at the time that she was pitching the investment, then the jurors have to convict. Same thing with the patients. If the prosecution's can prove that Theranos was under her supervision wiring electronic blood test results across state lines to patients that she knew were false, then the jurors have to convict. So it's a very simple, wire fraud is a very simple proposition, and that's why prosecutors often rely on it in cases like this one.
John, it strikes me, with this Svengali defense, that really, in order to believe it, you have to doubt the entire venture capital and investing system, because so often what investors say is that they're investing in the founder, in the story, in that person's ability to convince them not only of the legitimacy of their idea, but their ability to be, in a way, self-powered and self-willed and get it done. So is that something that we should expect, perhaps, the other side, the prosecution, to attack on? Is there were so many layers of people scrutinizing Elizabeth Holmes herself, and if someone had been controlling her, maybe they should have figured it out.
I mean, that's exactly right. Theranos was a cult of personality. It was a cult of one person, Elizabeth Holmes. She was the face of this company. She was the story of this company. And now the defense would have us believe that actually she had very little to do with what was going on. It seems very hard to believe because, remember, she held 99.7% of the voting rights of the company. Absolutely nothing at the company could be decided without her. The board couldn't even reach a quorum without Elizabeth Holmes. So I think it's going to be a very, very tough theory for the jurors to swallow. But then again, you know, she's a chameleon in my experience. I've been covering this for 6 years. And she's very good at projecting the front that she wants to project. And I just would not underestimate her ability to sway these jurors.
Well, it's possible that prospective jurors who read your book are being dismissed. So we will see what happens. John Carreyrou, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And as we head to break, check out shares of Okta, one of the biggest gainers on the NDX after posting a smaller than expected quarterly loss and issuing upbeat guidance. More Tech Check is after this.
Welcome back. Collaboration tools for teams have never been more crucial than they are now. An Australia-based enterprise software company, Atlassian, that's got a $95 billion market cap, has been ahead of the curve. For my Fort Knox Digital show, I spoke with Atlassian co-CEO and co-founder Mike Cannon-Brooks about how the pandemic has shifted how customers are using the product and the features his team is building.
We've certainly seen some usage trends change in software. You see a lot more bursts of highly synchronous work. If you think about that as a handful of people on a Zoom call really attacking a problem together, and then long periods of asynchronous work. So you need to manage both of that. Like, am I writing something that you're going to read 12 hours later, or am I writing it and you're going to read it 1 second later? Kind of becomes two extremes, I guess. And so we've done a lot of things to tweak the software to do that.
Also told me that building more humanity into software, those personality type features, is an important priority.
The other thing we've done is to add a lot more, continue to add more humanity into the software. So people want to show off their character, their personality. They want to personalize things. You know, we've got a large library of gorgeous photos, for example, in Trello to people change their backgrounds. That stuff can seem trivial, but in a world where you don't get to show up to work and put on different clothes to show off your personality, or, you know, you've got stuff in your cubicle or whatever, you know, people get a sense of who people are from talking to them. You have to move a little bit of that into the digital to give some flavor. So it's not just all sort of, you know, black and white documents. And lastly, I would say adding a lot more video and audio capabilities. Our management of video assets has greatly improved across our collaboration tools in the last 12 months, just because we're seeing a lot more video content being used. People, instead of writing a document or recording a video of themselves talking to make it more personal and putting it online. And so we've handled a lot more increase in video content.
Important competition space here. Think Asana, Microsoft with Teams, Salesforce with Slack. You can listen to the entire conversation with Mike. Hey, watch it. It's video, including a neat story on how he joined the bid to buy the Utah Jazz. Had to talk to his wife about it first, of course. You can find that on Tech Check's LinkedIn page and in our show Twitter stream. Julia.
Great stuff, John. I will check it out. And Bored Apes, Pudgy Penguins, and millions of dollars in profits. The latest on this summer's surge in NFTs. That's next. Tech Check is back in two. Let's get a gut check on Netflix. Shares are up about 2.5% today after rising yesterday, with the stock yesterday falling short of a record close, but still ending at its highest level since January. And Citi sees more gains for Netflix ahead, raising its price target to $595 from $570. The stock is up now. You see it up 2.5%. Netflix also announced that Seinfeld would begin streaming come October. And by the way, speaking of media, Viacom's Paramount just announced the new Top Gun movie will be delayed to next May because of COVID concerns. This movie was originally slated for a July 2019 release, so it's looking at a two-year delay, John.
Oh, that's a negative, Ghost Rider. The pattern is full. Meanwhile, NFTs exploded in popularity earlier this year and then seemingly tapered off, but the fervor is back. Robert Frank is reporting on how this bizarre half-art, half-crypto corner of the investment world is roaring back. Robert.
Good morning, John. The largest NFT trading platform, that's OpenSea, they saw sales volume of $3.5 billion in August. That was a record in more than 10 times the July sales. OpenSea did more volume in 1 month than Etsy did in the entire second quarter. Then you've got Axie Infinity. They're another platform. They did over $800 million in sales in August. Larva Labs did around $700 million. So NFT sales just in August topping more than $5 billion. The average price of an NFT is now $12,000. That's also way up. An NFT sold for at least $1 million every day in August. But this NFT 2.0, let's call it, which follows that first boom in March, it's being driven in large part by a whole new cast of cartoon characters. CryptoPunks are the most expensive. They now average $214,000 each, with one trading for more than $7 million. Visa just bought one for $150,000 to better understand the space. Catching up fast are the Bored Ape Yacht Club. Sotheby's about to auction off a Bored Ape NFT collection for between $11 and $18 million. NBA star Steph Curry, he just bought one for $180,000, and it became his Twitter avatar. And Pudgy Penguins, they're up more than 7,000% since they were created back in June. One sold for $500,000 just 2 weeks ago. Now that's been relisted for $2 million. And if you missed that pet rock craze back in the 1970s, well, Ether Rock, that's an NFT just sold to crypto mogul Justin Sun for $611,000. Another one has been listed for $28 million. Guys, they only made 100 Ether Rocks, and the cheapest one on the market right now is $2 million. Back to you.
Oh, well, if they only made 100. Oh, one of these days, back when we're all back in the office, they're going to have to stop by your desk so you can explain the Pudgy Penguins to me. The Bored Apes, I think I get, but not the Penguins.
Happy,
Robert, thanks.
Happy to do that.
Thanks. Meantime, keep an eye on Virgin Galactic today. Shares are taking off despite a new FAA investigation into the company's July launch and reports that the spacecraft veered out of its designated airspace mid-flight. You can catch that story on CNBC.com. Stay with us.
For today's Funding Secured, we're looking at the health tech space, which has exploded in the wake of the pandemic. A company at the center of it is Solve Health, today announcing a $45 million Series C funding round to fuel the growth of its software tools for healthcare providers to manage appointment booking and offer telemedicine, and for patients to find the ability to book same-day appointments. CEO Heather Fernandez saying the past year has gotten doctors and patients accustomed to getting their healthcare online.
There's this disaggregation of healthcare that is born out of frustration, whether it's from policymakers or the biggest health systems, and most importantly, consumers, which is enabling consumers to get more of what they need when they need it. And so, to be very specific, COVID accelerated our ability to grow our overall national network and work with partners. It significantly grew the number and volume of consumers that were coming to Solve for same-day care.
The company says that one in 16 Americans has used Solve to schedule care, and that includes COVID tests. You can find the entire interview with Solve CEO Heather Fernandez on CNBC.com/techcheck.
All right, will do. And if you missed part of the show, don't panic. You can follow and subscribe to our podcast. Listen anytime, anywhere, wherever you download podcasts. And Tech Check, back in a moment.
turning back to Apple and the latest in its App Store saga. The company now says it will allow developers of some apps like ebooks or video ones like Netflix to link from their apps to external sites for payments by users. This is just the latest concession Apple has made in maintaining its walled garden and the revenue and control that goes along with it. Joining us now to discuss, let's bring the Wall Street Journal's Joanna Stern. Joanna, I'm so curious for your thoughts on it. Bottom line question, is this a really big deal or not?
It's a deal. I don't know if it's a big deal. It's definitely a concession. I would say it's a smaller concession from Apple. On the developer point of view, I mean, this is a nice to have, right? What this does is it allows developers of reader apps, which really it means, you know, for people that are not in the in here, you know, the Netflix of the world, the Spotify's, those that want to get you to sign up for something where you can sort of consume content. In the past, you couldn't send people through an Apple App Store or through the Apple app to sign up for your service. So you had these companies basically off of the knees, not being able to get people to sign up for their services. Now this allows that. So it is a nice to have. It's certainly a nice to have as a consumer. Developers, I think they're going to think this is a small concession.
A small concession, but between this headline and the one about South Korea and the fact that there are these bills in Congress, do you think that this is going to be further accelerant, more fuel on the fire for another slew of regulations or necessary concessions?
Yeah, I think it all adds up. It's all adding up. It's certainly a nice PR play for Apple. Obviously, this was also driven by regulation in Japan. So, I mean, this isn't something they optionally did, you know, out of the goodness of their own hearts here. But we're also awaiting the Epic trial results. And so we are sort of in this wait and see with what Apple is going to do on its own and what it's going to be forced to do.
Joanna, it seems to me for investors, the takeaway here maybe is Apple is a vertically integrated company. They want to craft not just the hardware, but the software, as much as possible, the services behind it. And just because this one piece of the services model is being challenged and changed doesn't mean Apple won't figure out some other way to get paid, right? Isn't that what they have a history of doing?
Yeah, totally. And I think here, I mean, how many people are actually signing up through apps? I mean, when you think about what this does is it is nice for a consumer. You open an app, you can go sign up. Apple's not going to necessarily take a cut of that now. You can go outside, right? You'll be going through a website to do this. So that's really like what the, you know, on the ground, what changes. But yeah, Apple can basically do whatever they want to do in the future. And then we can have this all over again.
What's different about this App Store model that we have, particularly from Apple, but also from Google, which is being challenged with the Play Store as well, is a more tightly controlled store that has led to fewer issues when it comes to Trojans, viruses, fraud, that kind of thing. It seems in a way that even though Apple and Google are trying to put that into the conversation, legislators and governments aren't so focused aren't buying it.
I think we're going to be having a big discussion in a couple of months here, or there's going to be a lot more talk soon about these third-party app stores and what it could do to the platforms. That's obviously been Apple's biggest argument, right? What third-party app stores would do if those were to come onto the platform, the security, the privacy risks that are there. I think that's the conversation that's going to be where we're headed.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us, Joanna. We see Apple shares up nearly 1% today.
I thought I was here to talk about the iPhone, so.
Well, we can always talk about the iPhone, too. We got a new one coming out soon. Yeah. Well, after the bell, we're going to get Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, Broadcom, DocuSign, MongoDB, and PagerDuty. Julia, we were talking earlier about C3 AI after earnings. This is a stock that popped huge after the IPO, has come back to earth. They clearly have plans they were talking about with Google Cloud to expand, but that stock down 9% right now. We were also talking about collaboration software. Should note, Asana also had earnings last night. That stock is up 12%. Of course, founded by somebody you and I both know, co-founder of Facebook, Dustin Moskovitz.
Yeah, and Asana, one that we're watching. But I think this whole question, John, is as we watch the work from home space, the collaboration space, what are we going to see? Asana shares up 12%. What are we going to see in terms of the giants, John? How much are the Microsofts and Googles are going to make sure that they don't lose share here?
Yeah, maybe we just heard from Google yesterday. Maybe we'll hear from Microsoft soon. Keep tuned to Tech Check. And meanwhile, the halftime report starts now. Let's get to Brian Sullivan.
You've been listening to CNBC's Tech Check. You can always catch us live weekdays at 11 a.m.